This is Gary Wakefield, and you're listening to Queer Life Stories. Our podcast is recorded in La Truita, home of the Palawa people. We acknowledge the traditional owners of country, their diversity, histories and knowledge, and their continuing connections to land and community. We also acknowledge LGBTIQA+ advocates, friends and allies whose courage and strengths have helped to make this a more just society for lesbian, gay, bisexual, gender diverse and intersex populations and their families.
My name is Phoebe Adams and I'm also sometimes Barry Bothways, and I identify as queer and I'm gender non-binary, but I actually don't like pronouns at all, so you just pick one you like really, but I'd rather we didn't even have to use them.
Where did you grow up? What was family life like when you were little?
Well, top secret, not a Tasmanian. I was actually, I was born in Fitzroy at the hospital there. I grew up in East Ivanhoe, Heidelberg area. I don't know if you're familiar, well, you know the Yarra River. And there was the Heidelberg painters used to paint at the Yarra Valley, that area. That's where, not when they were painting, but yeah, I grew up there, just off the boulevard.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And were you an only child?
Yeah, I was an only child until I was 23.
Mm. Wow.
And I lived there until year 8, and then I moved to the country. So
Country Victoria?
Country Victoria, yeah, to my mum's hometown, 5 generations of Warrnambool in southwest Victoria.
Wow.
So that's sort of a town at the end of the Great Ocean Road, and it was a very beautiful place, but it was country. And that's where I came out when I was about 20 years old.
What were your parents like?
Well, my mum's actually non-diagnosed but is diagnosed because, funnily enough, my dad and my stepmom are psychiatrists, and I've sought much mental health support, as I think everyone should. My mum's actually a type of borderline personality disorder.
Okay.
So, and I was an only child, so life was pretty hard for me initially. I had ups and downs. She was very inconsistent. She was really great mum, could be fantastic, but if she got stressed, and when mum and dad were getting separated and divorced, that caused a lot of stress. She had a lot of trouble letting go of things, so objects, people, me. So yeah, it took a lot for me to kind of find myself within that relationship. Mm. Yeah, but I also loved my dad very much and saw him as much as I could, but the dynamic with my mum made that quite difficult at times.
Yeah.
Mm.
What age were you when they separated?
Dad was studying medicine and would find reasons to be away a lot, I think, when I was about 3. And they didn't divorce until I was 8. But I did spend a lot of time with a lot of extended family in Melbourne. So I sort of grew up until I was about 7 with a massive extended family, and then after the divorce everything kind of just fell apart, and then yeah, so good and bad, like everybody. But you know, you learn from the hard times.
Mm. Yeah. So after the divorce, is that when you moved to Warrnambool?
No. We stayed in Heidelberg, East Ivanhoe, a little longer. I moved there when I was 14.
And what was school like?
Well, I didn't go to school in Warrnambool. I used to catch a bus and go to a private school in Hamilton, which was 100 kilometres away.
Wow.
So I'd spend an hour on a bus in the morning and an hour on a bus in the evening, travelling 100 kilometres. That was great and pretty, but there was this bully up the back of the bus that didn't make life very pleasant. But, yeah, that was my experience of the country.
When did you start to think about sexuality and gender and those sorts of concepts?
I was thinking about gender at a really early age. I could also be, I've heard that people that are neurodivergent and female, or you know, born female, often form good friendships with boys at school because they're emotionally not as complicated. I would say I'm pretty good with emotions and things, but I used to hang out with the guys and stuff at school, and I remember thinking, well, maybe I was a guy. but because I liked all the things that the boys liked to do, but I didn't really enjoy any of the things that the girls liked to do. And I found them not as easy to be around. But again, that could be the neurodivergence. So in terms of gender, from the beginning, for as long as I can remember, I didn't feel what I was expected to be. But I figured that was the culture or the world at fault, not me, not my body. And I haven't really come to terms with being non-binary until, you know, recently, actually. Before then, I would say I was female, but I know I'm not. I'm more than female. I feel like I'm more, if that makes sense. In terms of sexuality, well, I just crushed on girls my whole life, really. I never felt attracted to boys. They were my mates. It was girls, and maybe that was also why I was uncomfortable with girls, but I think I fell in love with pretty much all my best friends. Yeah, so that was lovely. But I did, of course, go through a heterosexual phase, only because in the late 80s, early 90s, it was a lot of pressure to do that. We didn't have the words to describe a lot of feelings. I mean, when I came out when I was at university in Warrnambool at about 19, 20, we didn't have the internet. We had them at the university and green text on black screens. But to find out more about sexuality stuff, I looked at the dictionary and what homosexual was. Like, there was like one line and it didn't give me anything. Yeah. So I remember feeling quite isolated and alone because we lived just outside of Warrnambool in a little town called Woodford. There was no one there, so I was on my own. But the thing that sparked that knowledge of, oh, I think I am, is I was watching The Hunger with David Bowie, Susan Sarandon and Catherine Deneuve. I don't know if you've seen that. It's a vampire movie. But, yeah.
I think I have seen it.
Yeah, right. They get old. That's the people that the main vampire falls in love with, eventually they start aging rapidly. Anyway, the David Bowie character is aging and she finds a new love, which is this girl, Susan Sarandon. And it was the little raunchy scene between Susan and Catherine Deneuve that was like, oh, hang on. And then I went, oh, I'm bisexual. No. Well, the first thought was I'll just go partially there, but I have attraction. But no, and that, 2 months later I'm figuring out, nah, I'm definitely attracted to female people. But their gender now is really trouble. It's hard to use words now because how I identified and how I was then is very different to my mindset now.
Yeah, sure.
And when I came out, there was a way you had to be a lesbian, and that was, not that I minded, short hair and flannelette shirts and rainbow rings and I don't know. There was only one way to be, really. Oh, and then there was the leather scene. That was about it.
Yeah.
So, I'm so happy with the diversity now.
Yeah, me too. I'd never, like, for me, when the only gay imagery I ever saw was, like, these really immaculately put together, skinny, twink-type gay men. And I was like, I am the fat gay kid at school. Like, yeah. I am never going to fit that. I'm not going to ever be that gay.
That
was before I realised what bears were.
Look, I definitely identify as bear. In fact, when I lived in Sydney for 5 years, I used to hang out with the Harbour City Bears.
Yeah,
right. I think I was the only female to get let into the Stronghold bar they had there, and that was because I arrived with the boys and 12 bears and the president of the club. And they go, oh, no, sorry, no females allowed in here. And the president said, all right, then we'll go somewhere else then. This is our den mother. I was like 24, they're calling me the den mother. So, yeah, I really truly identify as with bear. Yeah. Woof.
So you came out when you were 19, 20. What was that experience like?
It was isolating. It was lonely. I didn't know what to do. I think I wrote to the Deakin University. That's where I went to their Women's Society in Geelong, and they wrote back to me and pretty much said, oh, good for you and not much we can do. So, but I heard about a queer collaborations conference that was on. It was in the, like, 1992 or 93, I think. So my years are terrible and bad with numbers. And I went off to that as a university student to this conference, and I met a girl, and then I moved to Sydney very quickly. So, and that's
for her.
Yeah, yeah. I think for myself, I think she was the catalyst. That we only lasted about 4.5 years, and it was she was an architecture student. Now she's an architect. She was really lovely, but we, you know, it was just your first relationship is. You're lucky if it's the one. It's your first relationship, but yeah, I wouldn't swap those Sydney years for anything. They were great. I found my pride in Sydney. I went from total isolation to being surrounded by, at times, thousands of queer people. I used to volunteer at the Mardi Gras workshop at Erskineville, and it was sort of a seasonal thing. You'd help work on party decorations and costumes and all the stuff they needed. It was full theatrical productions for each of the parties. So there was the sleazeball party in around October, I think, and which was a fundraiser, and then the Mardi Gras prop at the showgrounds, which was massive. So I used to love getting involved in all of that, and I was like a professional volunteer, I think, at the time. I had a lot of trouble getting work. I think it's because the expectations of dress and stuff in certain occupations sort of excluded me from. I would never wear a dress. I find wearing those sorts of. I wear a kilt, but I find wearing feminine things really. I feel humiliated almost. Like okay. School was hell having to wear dresses. I know it sounds silly. It's just an item of clothing, but it was one that made me feel very uncomfortable. So it was hard to find employment. But I volunteered full time, all the time when in my Sydney days. Yeah, I ended up doing some youth work with some youth refuges, did a traineeship with the Salvation Army, which at the time was not fun. I remember there was one day at the crisis refuge where one of the boys was putting on the girls' clothes that were left there, and I got in trouble for that, and I hadn't talked to them at all about anything. So they took me away and said, look, you can't be encouraging. I said, excuse me. So that sort of thing was not good working for a religious organisation. But then I went and worked for a queer-friendly youth refuge. So that was really great, and was on the management committee of 2010 at the time too, and continued my work with the Mardi Gras and the Mardi Gras board. So I was very busy with the community, and that was very enriching. I didn't care. At the time, I was on unemployment benefit most of the time. But, yeah, I wouldn't give that back for the world.
So you were in Sydney for
about five years.
And then what?
then I went back to Melbourne, actually, and to reconnect with my dad, and I went to TAFE there, to Swinburne, and got my digital media diploma, and I was ready to make interactive CD-ROMs because that's and kiosks because that's where it was going. yeah, and during that time I met my current wife, and yeah, we were together there for many years. I've been with her now for 20 years.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So how did you meet?
We met through friends, the old-fashioned way. There were chat rooms on the internet by this stage, so we could have met online. People were starting to do that. But no, we actually met through friends, and I thought she was cute when I first met her, but didn't think she was even gay. she looked like she'd been fruit picking. She was all ferally, and she was actually a little bit younger than me too, which I was like, I'm only talking 8 years, and she was 23. But as someone that had done youth work, it was a bit. But no, we just clicked so well, and I remember she chased me because I thought someone that cute couldn't possibly be interested in me, but she was. And yeah, the first time I kissed her, I knew that was it. 20 years later, we're still together. So, yeah, amazing. I've never had a kiss like that before. It is in the kiss, mate.
What were you doing in Melbourne for all those years?
Well, I was studying mostly. My brother was born then. He was a little boy, so I used to spend a lot of time taking care of him too at that point. I forgot. After then, I moved to Warrnambool and I started teaching interactive digital media. So it didn't matter that CD-ROMs weren't around because I still had skills to pay the bills in terms of teaching. So I used to teach that at Southwest TAFE in Warrnambool, Portland and Hamilton.
Oh, fantastic. How long did you do that for?
About 6 years, 5 or 6 years, I think.
And were those workplaces, were you out at those workplaces?
Yes, I certainly was. Yeah.
And what was the life like there? Was it culturally accepted or?
Well, Warrnambool's come a long way since I came out, and even then it was great. The first time I went into the TAFE when I was employed, I met somebody who said, "Oh, so are you of the ilk?" "Oh, you mean gay? Yeah, yeah, I am." So they organised that evening. It was about 15 women came to the pub and welcomed me and my wife. We weren't married then, of course. We were allowed to be married then. Me and my partner at the pub, and that was really, really lovely and welcoming. So we made friends pretty much straight away. My employer was fine and great with it, actually. And weirdly, I used to run classes called a Vet in Schools project. So kids that were in year 9, 10, 11 or 12, depending, would come along and do 4 hours on the Thursday afternoon. So, you know, like 1 till 5. Their brains tuned out at 3:30. They weren't used to it. But it was really interesting because I've kept in contact with a couple of those people, and a lot of them actually were just like me. They were neurodiverse or queer. So yeah. So I don't know whether they heard that there was this queer teacher or whether we were all attracted to this, multimedia, interactive digital media stuff. I don't know. But, So that was a really lovely experience. Yeah. And no, Warrnambool's a great little town. It's got a good little scene going on there.
We're recording this in Tasmania, so you did come back here.
Yeah.
Here at some point.
Yeah. Nat worked, my wife, partner then, worked for her parents. They imported wine and they decided they went on a holiday in Tasmania and just loved it. So they were going to move there. So they bought a place here and Nat worked for them. And I was hating my job at the time, not the teaching part but the paperwork part, because they privatised, they made TAFE people have to pay fees. Whereas before that didn't happen, so there was a lot of more paperwork on us in an area, in a field where you had to keep up with all the technology and the software. It was just crazy at the time. Like, there weren't even resources we used. We had to write our own because things were changing so rapidly in the industry. So I was ready to leave and get a real qualification. So I went, okay, well, you go and work for your parents in Hobart. We'll move there and I'll go to the art school and do fine art. And get a degree.
That's what you did?
That's what I did, yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so, we've been in Hobart now for 14 years and I got my Bachelor of Fine Arts with honours and tried to do a bit of a PhD for a bit, but then we got a baby and I got some health conditions and so I put that on hold till later on, really. But, yeah, achieved that goal and, we're having a good life here.
What was it like to try to connect into community here 14 years ago?
Well, I'm used to regional towns anyway, so I understood that it's, you know, get to meet people and it can be a slow process at first. I mean, Warrnambool was out, you know, I went out of the, like, that was crazy. They were so welcoming, but I think they were so desperate for new people. It's like this critical mass of regional, right? So if you have a regional to a certain point, people are like, wow, fresh person in town. And if it's really big, it's like, oh, yeah, another fresh person in town. So I understood that. But so it took a while to make connections here, longer than certainly Warrnambool, but they're strong ones. They're strong ones here. I think you've got to give everything time here in Tasmania. Just don't be in a rush. Mm. Take your time. People got to get to know you. But I find the queer community is really welcoming here.
What was the first queer thing that you found in Tasmania?
It was a marriage equality rally when we first came, before we moved here, to check it out. And Rodney Croom was speaking at it and I was very excited because, you know, a lot of people liked, I don't know, Spice Girls or Backdoor Boys or... I really liked Rodney Croom and Bob Brown. They were my heroes. So to meet my childhood hero was just fantastic. I've got him on my phone now, like... We're mates now, but back then that was big. And my partner and I got up and I spoke about why we wanted to get married, because that's what was happening at the time, and that was a nice way to make connections and meet people. Yeah.
So then who asked who to get married?
Oh, well, we'd actually proposed to each other when we lived in Melbourne, back in the Yarra Valley area, not Heidelberg, that was way, way, way back. I'm talking Lilydale, Mount Evelyn, Warburton. That's where we were living. We went on a trip on a little hot air balloon, and I decided that that was when I was teaching at TAFE at the moment. That was when I was going to propose to Nat because I knew she wanted me to. It had been over a decade. So we were up in the hot air balloon with some other people, and I asked her, and she said yes, and we put the ring, and they had a ring hiding in a teddy bear thing and right up in the sky. It was fantastic. And we subjected the straight people in the balloon to our wedding proposal, so no. they were great. So, yeah, and then it took so long to actually get married that the white gold engagement ring she wanted to have actually wore down to the point it had to be repaired now before we could even get married. So, yeah.
So when did you get married?
Well, when the plebiscite happened, I, like everybody else, was quite traumatised by the whole deal. Was just like, didn't you just feel like you were up for people's approval? Hey, country, do these people have a right to be human beings?
Yeah, please let me, please.
Yeah, please. Yeah, it just really, that was really bad time. Mm. I think that was probably one of my worst times as a queer person was during the plebiscite. Really affected us.
Mm.
So by the time we were able to be married, I was like, F you, weddings. I don't care about marriage. But we had a kid. We finally had a kid. We tried 9 years earlier, 9 times, nothing was happening with my eggs and her eggs. So we gave up. It's just too much. 9 times on was too much. Not me. I would never feel comfortable carrying a baby. Like, that's not my bag. But my wife had always wanted to do that. And, yeah, we gave up on that. But anyway, 9 years later, we tried again with a different clinic. And before they went ahead, they actually checked Nat's health things and stuff and found a few issues which got resolved. And first time we got pregnant. So
amazing.
We're at the hospital and there was all the paperwork. And you had to register your baby's name by a certain period of time. And if we had done the paperwork without being married, we would have had to get a justice of the peace to sign a stat deck and all this other stuff. And we just thought, our whole life will be just stat decks and bugger it. Let's do it just for the paperwork. So we got married on with our little baby with two witnesses and a celebrant on our back deck of our house. And it was the best wedding I've ever been to. It was so real. There was no, we didn't dress up or anything. We just wore our normal clothes, but it felt real. And it was actually more moving and more meaningful than we expected it would be. So actually that marriage thing is quite powerful even when you don't anticipate it's going to be.
Mm.
Yeah, but yeah, I've never been to such a good wedding. I fully advise people just do it in your casual clothes with people you care about and make it about you. Mm. That was
good advice.
Oh, look, I do theatre stuff all the time. This is a private moment for me and my wife after so long waiting to get married. Yeah. So yeah, that was great. Fantastic. And now we're married. Thank you, Rodney.
Yes, thank you, Rodney.
I've got a baby with a gender-neutral birth certificate. Thank you, Rodney.
Yes, again. Thank you, Rodney. Yeah. We might have to get Rodney on here.
I think you do.
So let's talk about some of the community stuff that you do. I see you're wearing your Barry Boothways shirt today.
Yes, a Shan Hooper design. Yep. Shan is Gary Snow and I'm Barry Boothways and sometimes we're joined by Dirty Damo and we do the Backdoor Boys Drag Kings troupe. Yeah.
And how did this happen?
Oh, good question. I went to a women's dance shortly after coming. Well, I think it was like 3 years. I'd been here for 3 years and there was a women's dance on. There hadn't been one for a while. Went to that and I saw Dick Swagger, Joe Watkin, who used to perform with Sandy Lagore at what was the name of the first club? I've got a mental blank. Sorry, perimenopause has got me. So a word's Sandy's Club. Les Girls, that's it. Yeah, she used to perform as sort of Sis characters there and was doing a drag king thing. And I thought, that is cool. I've been doing drag my whole life since a kid. I never played the princess. I always wanted to be the knight. That was how I was. I just related that way. So I thought, well, this is an opportunity for me to do that. And I like to perform, so let's do it. So the next one, I did a performance with Dick Swagger as Barry Boothways, which was a character I was working on anyway through my fine art degree, which was looking at sort of furniture objects and performativity and, you know, that whole culture in Tasmania around the designed furniture object and that sort of the bearded young man who does dovetails and that whole bit. Yeah, I was sort of trying to embody that. That's another story for another day. But, yeah, I'd worked on this character, Barry, for some time and had performed him at the Plimsoll Gallery as part of an art exhibition. He was kind of a safety inspector and he was about all the red tape that you have to go through to put shows on and stuff. So I just moved that character in with Dick and onto the stage and that was great. And from then on just performed it pretty much the opening of a cork from a bottle. I'd be there.
Yeah, so yeah. Barry's been around for a long time.
Baz has been around for about 13 years, I think. Yeah.
How important is it to you to have an outlet where you take on this other persona?
Well, yeah, Barry's an alter ego. So, yeah, he is actually an aspect of me, probably the who I'd be if I was a boy. I don't want to be male, though. I just want to be me. I want to be male and female. I want to be both. I want to be more. So Barry enables me to embody that in a really healthy way and a fun way. And he seems to bring people a lot of joy and laughter. So that's good. That's what I want to do. But on a personal note, if I don't let Barry out from time to time, he'll come out at really inopportune moments through humour that is not appropriate for someone as being perceived as female to make. You get away with a lot more when you're dressed as a bloke.
That male privilege.
Oh, yeah, and but your jokes are suddenly funnier too. It's great.
What about the community aspect of what you do? How important is that representing community?
Oh, look, I felt really like... I think I feel how if I was a Catholic and I wanted to be a nun because I loved the Catholic Church so much, I feel like I'm kind of a queer sort of some sort of devotee. I love doing things for my community. It's what enriches me. That's what makes me feel good. I think it comes out of that feeling I had when I was first coming out of being completely alone and isolated, and I just don't feel that anybody needs to go through that. That's not right. And it's not right to walk the world feeling like you can't hold your partner's hand in public, and that's not right. So when I think something's not right, I have to fix it. And there's a lot of things out of my control, but some things I can help fix. And if doing stuff for my community, I do a lot of other volunteer work stuff too. We haven't got all day for the amount of stuff I do, but I do it because I have to. It's like a calling. I think I'm sad if I'm not doing stuff with my community.
Mm. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. I think you're a bit the same.
Do I need to admit that on here?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I am a bit the same.
Being diagnosed also as neurodiverse, I have attention deficit disorder. When I was a child at school, I was diagnosed with hyperactivity. That's what they called it then. But my dad wouldn't allow me to be on the medication, which was probably Ritalin or something at the time. So I've grown up with that. And also recently my psychologist, I've also got CPTSD, which is a complex post-traumatic stress from experiences, I think a lot of queer people have got a lot of traumatic experiences, but I also had the double whammy of my mum's mental illness. So that caused a lot of trauma for me. And then I've also got some spectrum-y traits on top of that. But it's very difficult for them to tease out CPTSD, ADD and ASD. It's a very tangled web. But we just say I'm neurodivergent. And knowing that and having a proper diagnosis later in life has also been really validating. I remember my psychologist said, so, Phoebe, how would you feel if we actually find out that you've got ASD and ADD, what would you say to yourself? And I'd say, bloody good job. For God's, look at what you've done with all of those things. Look where you are. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So, I reckon the best gift you can give to yourself is give yourself a pat on the back and say, considering the things that you have to deal with in life as a queer person, as a neurodivergent person, you've done really bloody well simply just to stay alive, to be honest with you. Like, to be here, to have a nice relationship, to have a little kid now, to have a nice life, steady job, all those things.
And have such a positive impact on the community around you.
And have such a beautiful community to be part of.
Media representation of queer people and how you've seen that change.
Oh, yeah, I've got a good example for you. Okay, so I'm 18 years old. I'm gone to Warrnambool University, the Deakin University campus there. I've got my gay friend who I met through a little period of homelessness during year 11 and 12. I wasn't technically on the street homeless, I was just living between friends and family houses a lot. Anyway, one of the family houses, I met this gay guy who helped me come out. His name was Constantine Alexopoulos, and I want people to remember him because he passed away because of HIV. Anyway, when I was walking down that street in Warrnambool with my friend Constantine Alexopoulos, who had HIV, hadn't told us because didn't want to upset us, and the newspaper there, the local newspaper, was saying that everybody with AIDS needs to be sent to an island, preferably, get this, Tasmania, away from everybody else. So that's where the media was when I was 18. And that's miles behind where it is now. And it still needs to improve, but that was a shocking thing to have to, yeah, not real great for my friend either.
No, that's awful.
Yeah.
And I guess now in the media, a lot of the attacks that we're seeing are against trans and gender diverse
trans people. And gender diverse people are copying it like crazy. It's wrong. It's so wrong. I'm trying to do what I can to stop it. But it's actually repugnant, repulsive, and really like where you can kick people that are so vulnerable anyway. And I identify as non-binary trans, but I'm 51, so I'm strong, but I'd hate to be a young person that doesn't have that full sense of pride in themselves, hasn't developed that, and have to read the stuff they have to read, the stuff the TERFs say online. And I don't know how people can be so mean. I don't know why this Trumpian type of behaviour has started, this whole let's just not worry about science and facts and the real thing, or even people. We just, whatever conspiracy theory, whatever ridiculous statement we want to make, we just want people to watch whatever we're saying and tune into us, and who cares who gets hurt along the way. That's what it feels like.
Yeah.
You know, saying outrageous things. I don't think they even believe the crap they talk about. I think it's attention seeking on behalf of the haters. And if there's any trans folk listening, don't listen to them. They're all actually not very mentally well, in a bad way. Whereas, you know, you are 100% valid, and you, people like you, have existed for millennia, and exist in nature, exist in animals, in fish, in insects. The queerness in gender and sexuality has always been this binary thing. It's a flash in the pan historically. They're wrong. You're right.
Well said. Have you experienced any hardships or discrimination based around your sexuality or gender identity?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Do you have a...
I've never felt example? Comfortable holding my wife's hand in public.
Still?
Just number one, yeah. Unless we're at a queer event or party, I've just been abused so many times that I'm scared to. And even abuse that isn't even verbal, it can be the look, you know, or the double take. If I ever get misgendered and someone calls me, say, sir, I always smile and laugh because I think that's great. People are like, oh, you're weird. I'm like, I love it when they call me sir. That's fantastic. I just fucked with them. Sorry, he's a naughty word. Bleep that. I said, I love that. I love making people not sure about the things they're sure about, not sure about binaries, not sure about sexuality. I mean, if you look at the Kinsley Report, most people are bisexual. Strict heterosexuality and strict homosexuality are actually the rare things, even in nature.
I'm exactly the same. Like, my partner and I have been together 12 years, and he would be comfortable just holding hands in the street.
So would my wife.
Can't. I just can't do it. I remember the anti-gay rallies in Ulverston where I grew up. Like, I just can't.
You grew up in Ulverston with anti-gay rallies?
Yeah.
But Rodney Cream was going to?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah. When you've been through that, when you've seen the hate in people's eyes and the disgust, like you just, I don't know, like you came out of some bog and just it's the shame that they want to put on you. It takes a lot to grow that I can't be shamed skin back, and it's, and I don't feel shame, I feel pride, but I just don't want to have to deal. It makes me angry when that happens. I don't want to have to deal with that emotion anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, I feel the same.
Yeah.
I even struggled. We went to San Francisco last year and we went to the Castro, like the gayest, might be the gayest place on earth. And I couldn't even do it there. We got a quick little kiss selfie outside Harvey Milk's house and that was it.
That's a rip-off to us. I mean, that's ripped us off from the beautiful life experiences that people, the heteronormative have. They don't even have to think about that. But we have to think about our safety when we want to show love. That's a big discrimination. Other discriminations, of course, as recently as when I was doing a fine art degree here in Hobart and I wanted to get – I was probably not the right body type for them, but I think that's changed a bit now. But Mona, if I wanted to work for Mona then, I would have had to wear one of those bloody canvas skirts. Mm. I don't think that's the case now, but even – well, I'd hope not. I would have had to wear a skirt and done that whole thing. And like I said, I put me in a kilt, okay, but I can't wear heteronormative feminine clothing because I – feel like I feel humiliation. I feel shame. It's not right for me, unless Barry's enabled me to wear a dress, because Barry, not me, Barry has got a drag queen character.
Does he?
Yes, not me. Barry does. Called Eileen Both Ways. yeah. We wanted to sort of tribute Pussy Poppins once, so we did a little did drag queen characters.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
So Dirty Damo was Dirty Debbie and Gary Snow was Saffron Snow and Barry Bothways was Eileen Bothways. And, we just did a little quick number in front of Pussy to what was Andrew sitting there to tribute them. So
then
it became a thing. So, yeah.
If you could go back and give your little self a message, what would that message be?
It would be you're going to be okay. It gets better. How old am I at this point?
Wherever you feel the most.
Maybe the little 20-year-old that's trying to come to terms with their sexuality watching Susan Sarandon and Catherine Deneuve rolling about in the sheets. And just say, no, look, you are totally 100% who you are. You're going to find that person and culture will change around you and you will help make culture change around you. And just try and find who you are and be that.
Yeah, amazing message. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure, absolute pleasure. Anytime. There's a lot more in that book if you want to pull it out later.
Thank you. If this episode has raised any issues for you, please take some time to reflect and ensure you reach out for support if you need it. If you are listening in Tasmania, you can contact Working It Out via their website or calling 6231 1200 during business hours. If you need immediate mental health support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or Beyond Blue on 1300 224636. Both services are available 24/7. If you would like to get in touch or share your story on this podcast, please send us an email at nwpride@outlook.com. This podcast is produced by Northwest Pride, a community group based across the north, northwest and west coast of Tasmania. They host events and social inclusion opportunities for anyone who is a part of the LGBTIAQ+ community, their friends and allies. This podcast is made possible by the support of Working It Out. You can hear future episodes and all of our past episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. Please follow, rate and review if you can. It does help us to reach more folks who might enjoy or benefit from hearing these amazing life stories. We'll be back soon. Take care of yourself and each other.